on This Week in Enterprise Tech. The Monkey Boy falls, tapping is on the rise, and Windows 8.1 drops. Quiet on the set.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Enterprise Tech is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is TWiT, This Week in Enterprise Tech, episode 56, recorded August 26, 2013. Busted Windows. This Week in Enterprise Tech is brought to you by RingCentral. We do everything in the cloud. That's why I love my cloud-based phone system by RingCentral. Zero startup cost and RingCentral is $20 per month per user. Try it now with a 30-day risk-free trial and buy one desk phone and get a second phone free up to 20 phones. Call 800-543-9980 or visit ringcentral.com and use our promo code TWIT. And by Lookout, a mobile security company trusted by over 40 million customers. Lookout specializes in stopping new cyber threats, finding lost or stolen phones, and backing up data. Protect your Android or iOS device now by visiting lookout.com/enterprise for a free download. Welcome to TWiT, This Week in Enterprise Tech. It's the show dedicated to the enterprise professional, the IT pro, and the geek who just wants to know how the world is connected. I'm your host, Father Robert Ballas here, the digital Jesuit, your guide to all things in the enterprise. And I've got an absolutely star-packed show for you, starting with my good friend, Mr. Brian Chi, the geek in paradise, the director of the Advanced Network Computing Laboratory at the University of Hawaii. Brian, how are things over in the land of waves and volcanoes?
It's actually hot and humid, but I am getting ready to head out to the other side of the island and hook up a brand new gig pipe. So my underwater observatory is going to jump from a 3 megabit per second link to a full gig. It's going to be awesome. And we're going to be streaming HD video live from 3 miles underwater.
It sounds awesome. And I think you just came up with our show title, Hooking Up with a Gig Pipe. Also hooking up with our gig pipe is Mr. Curtis Franklin from Enterprise Efficiency. Curtis, thank you for coming back. You're over on the East Coast now, anchoring us on the other side of the country. How are things with you?
Padre, things are very good. Back in the digital swamp this week after being down in South Florida last week. Had a great time, but it's good to be back here where all things are air-conditioned and construction is underway. So happy to be here. Happy to be back in cool, crisp North Florida for a change.
Joining us after a long hiatus from the show, I'd say the conscience of TWiT, the Jiminy Cricket on my shoulder, Mr. Oliver Wrist. Oliver, thank you for coming back. What have you been doing since the last time you were on TWiT?
Absolutely nothing technical. I'm in the middle of trying to move back to the East Coast, the Northeast. So I'm surrounded by boxes and broken decks and paint cans. So, yeah, my technology projects have taken a backseat. Except for you, of course.
Of course, of course. Well, I mean, you're always in my hard drive.
Yeah.
That sounds wrong. But you know what's not wrong? Our last panelist, and I'd say that she has a certain expertise that we really need for this episode of TWiT, Miss Mary Jo Foley. That's right, from All About Microsoft. She is the queen of everything MS. Mary Jo, thank you for coming back. It's been a while, and it's been a crazy weekend, right?
It has been both.
Been both. Yeah. We're going to get right into that, because that's going to be our lead story, which is, of course, all about Microsoft. Microsoft had a huge announcement. In fact, two major announcements this week. And it's really sort of shattered the enterprise world. Of course, I'm talking about their announcement of the Xbox. Okay, no, totally. That's not it. It's about Ballmer saying that he's going to leave the company in the next 12 months, probably a lot sooner than that. Last week, we had a news item made public on August 23rd, where Ballmer had announced that he would be stepping down as CEO of Microsoft, that a search committee is working on finding a successor, and that even though he had previously indicated that he would stay on until his youngest was in college, which would have been until 2018, he is, in fact, looking at stepping down as soon as possible. Mary Jo, I want to throw this to you first because you got the scoop. You actually got to talk with the man right after this announcement. Tell us a little bit about those 15 minutes on the phone.
Okay. So I haven't gotten a chance to interview Steve Ballmer for 20 years, except up until last Friday. And I, you know, I've been covering technology 30 years. So I did interview him before in the early part of my career. And then for some reason, I wasn't allowed to interview him. So it was kind of a surprise to get a phone call Friday saying, hey, do you want to interview Steve Ballmer now that he's resigning from the company and retiring? So I took the 15 minutes and I, you know, there's certain things you had to ask him, you know, what was your biggest success, your biggest regret? The biggest regret, by the way, was Vista and the whole kind of, as he called it, the loopity loop between Longhorn and Vista, meaning, you know, that whole reset they had and how everyone got distracted and they tied up the whole Windows team for years until they could finally get Vista out. And then customers didn't like Vista. So yeah, that whole mess was his biggest regret. And then, you know, it was very interesting to talk to him about kind of what his feelings were about this because, you know, his whole life has been Microsoft. He's employee number 30. He's been at the company since 1980, I believe. And you could tell by just the way he was answering questions that it wasn't probably a willing departure, I would say. He said he made up his mind just 2 days before when they had a board call and he had decided that it was going to be time for him to step aside and for them to get a new CEO. So it's a true end of an era. He's been, along with Bill Gates, the face of Microsoft. And now everyone's trying to figure out who can fill his shoes.
Right, right. Curtis, I want to throw over to you because something that came out of Mary Jo's interview was a peculiar line. Ballmer claimed that the board at Microsoft has been talking about succession planning for 10 years and that 3 or 4 years ago he agreed to meet with candidates, potentials to fill the CEO role. And so in essence, he was saying, oh, yeah, this is no big thing. This is not a surprise. We've been planning this for a long time. This has been in the works. But something about that just sounds wrong. Do you think that this is something that they were planning on? Maybe they're accelerating a tiny bit? Or is this something that really kind of jumped up on them?
Well, I think that the eventuality of his leaving is something that they've been dealing with. A company the size and scope of Microsoft, the board would have not been exercising good fiduciary responsibility if they had not been talking some sort of succession plan. The only person who could have gotten away without a clear succession plan was Bill Gates, and that's because of his stock position. Someone like Ballmer, even though he does have a sheer boatload of stock, he still has to have a succession plan. That's very normal. There's nothing unusual about that statement. I do think the timing is very interesting, and I think that what we're seeing is the sort of change in the industry that, for example, Michael Dell has been responding to in trying to take his company private, rippling through Microsoft in a huge way. Everyone understands that the industry of this decade is going to be substantially different than the industry of the last decade and the decade before. What we don't have a clear idea of is precisely what the industry is going to look like at the end of this decade. And that's really what Microsoft wants, a CEO who can tell them. They want someone who can say, here's where we're going to be going for the next 10 years. Here's how we're going to be getting there. And yet have enough flexibility, enough intelligence to guide them if the market decides that that particular vision is wrong. It's going to be a tricky game to play, especially for a company the size of Microsoft's. I don't envy the next chairman, and I don't think it's going to be a quick process getting there.
Okay. I want to go into the next corollary to this, and this is actually a sensitive subject because I don't want it to feel as if we're piling on. But there are a lot of facts about, Microsoft over the past decade that don't look really good about Ballmer's tenure. During his tenure, Microsoft stock has seen a 36% drop in share value. That's according to Forbes. And the announcement of Ballmer's departure resulted in a 7% plus increase in Microsoft stock price. So, of course, people think that this is good. We want to see change. We want to see a new direction for the company. We'd like to see someone else in that seat. Chibert, I want to throw this over to you. And then over to you, Kurt. Over to you, Oliver. Do you think that the decline of Microsoft, this disaster that has been Vista and Windows 8 and a bunch of smaller projects that have fallen to the wayside, is this a direct thing from Ballmer, or are we just trying to associate the man with all the failures of Microsoft without having the know?
You know, I don't know. This is clearly a case of armchair quarterback. Managing a corporation that size just cannot be easy. And, you know, if I was to sit back and say, what could they do better? I'd say, well, Mr. Ballmer, you got started on trying to get divisions to talk to each other, but all the rifts got in the way. My personal opinion is there's an awful lot of really good technology, a lot of really good knowledge, a lot of really good products that never became products, and that the industry is starting to demand that more things talk to each other. So I think the start that Ballmer got with setting up communications between divisions, I think that needs to go on. And that's going to be my armchair quarterback for the day.
Yeah, Oliver, let me throw over to you because we've got a really good comment in the chat room from Web9312 who said, Steve never blamed anyone else. He always claimed the buck stopped with him. That's kind of true, right? I mean, you never saw Steve publicly coming out and saying, oh, it's his fault for this. It's their fault for this. They screwed this up, and therefore that's why I'm still a genius.
Yes. I mean, and that's a popular saying, you know, the buck stops with the CEO, and, you know, you can believe that philosophy if you want, but in a company that size, that's basically BS, right? He's protecting people who actually screwed up underneath him. If I give him credit for his big mistake, to me, it's the change in culture from Gates, right? It's he set up the culture where he can be lied to. In fact, he's encouraging people. There's a lot of politics underneath him that have nothing to do with him, and it's very difficult for one guy to sift through a whole bunch of, you know, backstabbing between guys who are under him at the middle level. And yeah, he's kind of responsible for that. But on the other hand, I don't think the culture at Microsoft is a positive about Microsoft anymore, right? Under Gates, everybody could have been a millionaire in 5 years. So of course you're loving your company. That's not going to happen now. And I don't think that's entirely him. They're going through a corporate evolution and he's trying to ride that out.
Can I throw in one stat here?
Absolutely.
Too, that we haven't talked about? You know, this is the one everybody kind of glosses over. They, under Ballmer, Microsoft tripled revenues and doubled profits. You know,
exactly.
Like everyone's like, oh, it's a failure, right? But it's like, yeah, okay, they have not had a great success rate in some consumer gadgets like the Kin and Windows Phone, I'd say, is another one. But if you look at their products that have made money, the ones that we love on Twiot, but other people don't know about, like System Center and Windows Server and SQL Server, Windows Azure, Office 365, these have been pretty big successes. So I think you've got to balance this chatter out about, you know, it's been all downhill.
Right. Actually, thank you for bringing that up, both you, Oliver, and Mary Jo. The perceived failure of Microsoft, when you actually look at the breakdown, the financials, it's not a failure. They may not have exploded as much as, say, a Google or an Apple, but he's kept the path and he's actually kept the company in profitability. So my question to the panel, and this is an open question, is why is there such a negative perception of Microsoft? Why do we just assume that everything they do is going to be a disaster? Why do we assume Windows 8 is an absolute Titanic when the numbers coming back are actually that it's a profitable operating system?
Padre, I'd like to take that.
It's just popular to slam Microsoft.
It is.
Curtis?
Right.
Sorry. Well, I think that it is somewhat popular to slam Microsoft, especially coming out of the period around when he took over, when they were a much larger company. We've seen the same thing at Apple. The day almost that Apple was declared the largest company in the universe, it became very popular to start slamming them. We appreciate in our culture the struggle to the top. We hate it when a company actually makes it there. But a bigger thing is that the stock price is an indication of how the market thinks the company is going to behave or perform in the future. And what we have decided is that we need our technology companies to absolutely blow our socks off, change our world every couple of years. That's getting harder and harder to do. Microsoft has found it harder to remain loyal to the customers they already have while making dramatic change. Difficult thing to do. Apple is finding it difficult to do the same thing. IBM found it difficult to do the same thing. Shocking us. Really changing the way we do things is getting harder and harder. And unfortunately, that's what the market wants. And that's what the market has punished Microsoft and Steve Ballmer for not delivering.
Mary Jo, I want to throw this over to you because I know you've covered this a little bit in Windows Weekly. Is this just a sign of a mature company? You're seeing somewhat of the same thing in Apple right now, where they've had great success, but they've reached a level of maturity where it's much more difficult for them to pivot. It's much more difficult for them to innovate without alienating their customer base. Did Microsoft just get so big so fast that it was impossible for them to come up with, you know, what Curtis is talking about with that revolutionary look at the way we use hardware slash software? That we just assume that there has been. We just assume that they're done and they're gone.
Yeah, I think there's this weird false perception that Microsoft doesn't innovate enough. And I would actually say with Windows 8, they innovated too much. I think they went too far too fast, and they went ahead of their customer base even. Not everybody's ready for a touch laptop. Not everybody's ready for a tiled interface when they're so used to using their PCs with multiple windows. So I don't think it's fair to say they have been lagging or that they don't know how to disrupt the market anymore. I mean, they disrupted the market with the Kinect very much so, I would say. I think where I see them having a problem is they are a very huge believer in the whole BYOD consumerization of IT trend. And I asked Ballmer, I said, why didn't you, quote, just be IBM? Because you're so successful in the enterprise. Why not just be an enterprise company? And they actually believe they can't be one without the other. They think they have to be successful in consumer to continue to be successful in the enterprise. I'm not sure I buy that, but that's what they firmly believe. That's what the board believes. And that's why they keep throwing money into things like Windows Phone and Bing and all the things they're doing with Xbox and Kinect. They really think they can't just rest on their enterprise laurels, and they have to be successful in consumer too. And now, you know, with their new charter of being a devices and services company, there's a ton of focus on them being successful with the Surface. And, you know, the first generation Surfaces did not do well, neither the RT nor the Pro, but they are going to come back with more Surfaces this year, we believe. So I think they just are going to keep going at that. And that's where they're going to have to really balance out. I mean, if they get a CEO who knows a lot about the enterprise, will he or she know enough about the consumer side? Or if they go consumer, will they pick somebody who also knows enough about the enterprise? It's these two gigantic kind of disparate businesses that they're in that I think makes it challenging for them to continue to really roll forward in a way that everyone thinks they're on top of the game.
Right. Mary Jo Foley, I want to talk a little bit about another event that you covered, and that was back in October of last year when Ballmer announced that they were going to reorganize the company, and then this past July when he actually started breaking down the walls between divisions, they were doing exactly what you spoke of, which is trying to find that nexus between the consumer and the enterprise, the devices and services, and the old way of looking at Microsoft products. Now, at the time, it was confusing. I think now it's even more confusing. Do you have a better understanding of what they want? This devices and services idea that Microsoft is now selling devices that have an added-on value from Microsoft operating system, that they provide service for third-party companies making devices with Microsoft software. Do we know exactly what that is?
Yeah, you know, it's been funny this past week watching everybody talk about, you know, what Ballmer's going to do now and the reorg and all. And I actually think the reorg makes a lot of sense. I think before, the way Microsoft's been organized, they had these five silos, right? They had like Windows Client, Windows Server. They had the Enterprise Division, which also included Windows Phone. They had Online Services. And, you know, these were all very, sorry, the other one was Office Division. So all of these were doing their own thing. They weren't really talking to each other very much until fairly recently. And I think what their new missive is, and they're going to have to find a CEO who believes in this, is that all of these things need to be bridged. There have to be common platforms that you can depend on having the same set of services, the same email client, maybe the same store for applications. I think that's what this reorg is all about. It's kind of breaking down those silos that have existed in Microsoft for a long time and kind of empowering the company to have devices, both their own and third-party devices, that run services from Microsoft. So things like Azure, Office 365, you know, they have all these consumer services too, like Outlook.com. They have SkyDrive, they have Xbox Live. So they already have all these things, and it's just now a matter of them actually tailoring this and getting them into the right places on their own devices and competitors' devices too.
We'll be talking all about what's next for Microsoft as soon as we come back. But first, I wanted to take a moment to talk about the first sponsor of the Twilight Riot, and that, of course, is RingCentral. Now, when Leo built this studio, this beautiful studio that you see around me, he decided that we should eat our own dog food. We've been telling people that they should go into the internet for their services, that they should put everything in the cloud. And so when our IT guy, Russell, came to us and said, hey, you can have a full-featured phone system, but not have to have any of that bulky PBX hardware in the basement, well, it was a no-brainer. We love RingCentral. We get zero startup costs, no PBX hardware to install or maintain. RingCentral allows us to customize all of our call handling. Our producers can get their voicemail in their emails, and we can even get our fax messages right on our smartphones. And now they have a brand spanking new feature, Business SMS. Now you can send text messages to your customers and colleagues from your business phone number. No more using your personal number. It looks more professional. It looks more like you. So here's what I want you to do. I want you to try RingCentral. RingCentral offers all-inclusive pricing as low as $20 per month per user. And you can start right now with a 30-day risk-free trial. They have a special offer for my listeners. When you buy one desk phone, you get a second phone free up to 20 phones. So call this number, designated for my listeners, 800-543-9980. That's 800-543-9980. Again, 800-543-9980. Or you can go to ringcentral.com and use the promo code TWIT. That's ringcentral.com, promo code TWIT. And we thank RingCentral for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Let's get back into it. We've been speaking a little bit about what has to happen next. Let's put Ballmer behind us. Whether or not you love him, whether or not you hate him, he did what he did, and Microsoft is where it is. Now, what do they have to do to be a success in the next decade, the next 10 years, the next 20 years? We've got a couple of opinions. The first one from Wired, which suggests that Ballmer's departure comes 10 years too late. They essentially say that the battles that are worth fighting right now have already been won and lost. The battle for the tablet, the battle for the mobile device, the battle of the web. Well, Microsoft really can't make headway into those. Those markets are mature and it's past. They suggest that Microsoft can only regain its position by leapfrogging Apple, Google, and Amazon. So let me go over to you first, Tiebert. What do you see Microsoft having to do in order to make that leapfrog complete? What do they have to do to prepare themselves for the next 10 years?
You know, the consumer market is confusing. You know, no, Android seems to be really going great guns and so forth. I think the big market that Microsoft needs to concentrate on actually isn't going to be in the consumer market. I think it's going to be seen by the consumers, but I think it's going to be the embedded market. Right now, Microsoft is losing lots and lots of ground to both Android and Linux. You know, things like gas pumps, cash registers, you know, we're starting to see this wildly popular iPad-based cash register now. This all used to belong to Microsoft. So now with Windows 8.1 and the ability to actually disassociate the GUI from the main operating system, I hope, I think that's going to make a pretty big difference, because the guys that are building these enterprise-grade devices, cash registers, gas pumps and so forth, they need the tools. They need to be more modern, but yet Windows XP embedded just didn't give them enough, and Windows 7 embedded was an orphan child. I think Microsoft really needs to take the embedded world by storm, and I think they still have a lot of room to improve.
What about it, Oliver? Do you think Microsoft just needs to win back the territory that used to belong to them?
I think it needs to do that, as well as, yeah, you can say innovate, but the way they're going about it is in a very practical way. And yeah, I agree with Brian. Yes, they're losing the POS side, but you know Microsoft, they're going to win it back, right? Linux has it now, but Linux, all those things, OpenStack, they tend to run on hype, just like Apple. Sooner or later, Microsoft will slowly gain that back, and they'll leapfrog in functionality, and they'll definitely own service, right? So I don't see them in as bad a position. I don't see why the stock price is where it is. I certainly don't see why it's all Ballmer's fault.
I love that idea of you know, Linux being du jour right now. But Curtis, let me throw over to you. Oliver wrote an article not too long ago about OpenStack, and it was a really, really good article using several case studies. One of them, which was supplied by some priest in the East Coast, I can't remember who it was, but who ran a lot of IT systems for a lot of different universities. Well, he mentioned this case study in which you had several universities trying OpenStack and eventually going back to a Microsoft solution, essentially saying, look, we know that it's not perfect, but at least we know where the devil is. We know where the difficulties are going to be. We know the weaknesses, and we can work around them versus something that is so dynamic that what works one week may not work the next. Is this a resurgence of Microsoft? Will we slowly start to see them take back those markets that traditionally have belonged to them?
Well, I think we're already seeing some of that. One of the things that I have noticed over the past few years is a growing number of companies willing to put their large-scale back-end on Microsoft platforms. As recently as a decade ago, companies weren't willing to do that because, frankly, the combination of hardware and software wouldn't support true enterprise class dependability and throughput. That's why you still had so many people putting their backends on things like the IBM AS400 platform, the things that that's morphed into, or other mini computers, or even mainframes. Today, the mainframe niche has become much smaller. It is basically a huge I/O engine that drives that kind of very transactional application. For most other things, a Microsoft and Intel solution works just fine. What Microsoft really needs to do, though, is one of two things, and they need to decide on a direction. Either they need to continue this commitment in the cloud and become the premier services company to the enterprise, or they need to come up with a way to tell the story that convinces the enterprise why the Microsoft traditional client-server model is better than the cloud. Right now, they're trying to do a bit of both. I really think they need to decide that one of these horses will be the one that they ride for the next decade, get on it, flog the dickens out of it, and ride it to success. If they try to keep one foot on each of these horses, the possibility of a truly ugly spill is still out there.
Mary Jo, let me throw over to you. We've got some major outlets, the New York Times, Wired, Vanity Fair, the Wall Street Journal, all saying essentially that Microsoft needs a catch-up artist. They need someone who is going to hard pivot the company. It's time to panic. It's time to throw out the game book and go with something new. What's your take? Having actually spoken with a man, having covered Microsoft for so long, having been invested in what Microsoft does, is it time to panic? Is it time to go crazy? Or do they stay the course?
I wouldn't say it's time to panic. I mean, it's always funny to see people's predictions like, you know, in 5 years, Microsoft's not going to be here. I don't think people have a real understanding of how deeply embedded Microsoft is in really big, big companies. Like, you know, they're always like, oh, they don't have the love of the startups. Well, they have the love of the banks, and they have the love of the insurance companies, and they have the love of government agencies. I mean, they have a very established big client base. So I don't think it's time to panic at all. I do think it's time to consider whether or not you go inside or outside for the next CEO. And I wrote a post last week about who the leading inside candidates are. And it's very interesting who they're thinking about from what my sources are saying. The leading three inside, from what I'm hearing, are Satya Nadella, who runs the enterprise business at Microsoft right now. He runs the cloud and enterprise services. Tony Bates, who came to Microsoft when they bought Skype. He was the CEO of Skype, and now he's the head of developer evangelism and is going to be doing some of the mergers and acquisition work at the company. And the third is Terry Myerson, who is a really longtime Microsoft guy. He has been running Windows Phone engineering as of late, but now he also is in charge of running Windows operating system division and the Xbox operating system division. And so they're putting those three operating systems together and making that a separate division. Right. They're not really looking at, from what I've heard, at people who recently left Microsoft. They're probably not going to go with Elop, I don't think, who is running Nokia now. Probably not going to go with Steven Sinofsky, who left Microsoft as the Windows chief. Some of the other names that have been bandied about as former people, like Paul Moritz, who's working at VMware now, or actually at Pivotal now. So I don't think they're going to go that route, though. I think those are that's one set of ideas is you stick with the people who are inside, who really know how Microsoft works. But I think they're probably going to go outside. And I think that'll be more for image than anything else. But their challenges there are two. One is outsiders never, ever succeed at Microsoft. The people who they brought in the past from the outside, they almost never win. I mean, they stay for a bit. They can't really negotiate the political waters there, and they leave. Ray Ozzie is a good example of that. The other problem is, how do you find somebody on the outside who can know about the whole diverse set of things that Microsoft does? Because unlike Google or unlike Apple, Microsoft is in everything from gaming consoles to phones to embedded operating systems to the cloud, to Windows Server. And how do you find somebody who has enough working knowledge about so many kind of integrated parts that they could come in and even with the best senior leadership team advising them actually do a competent job of running the company? So I think they want to go outside, but I don't know if they actually will, and maybe they'll stay inside for the candidates.
I want to do one last bit for this before we have to move on. And I'm going to start with you, Chiebert. Let's put aside names for a second, because it's too easy to pull out names of superstar CEOs and potential candidates. If you had someone coming in, what would be the one thing that you would want him or her to do, or the one thing that you would want him or her to institute at Microsoft? What's that bit of strength, that bit of position that they would need most in order to make Microsoft into the company that you want to see as an enterprise user, as an administrator, that you would want to see for the next decade?
I think Microsoft needs to play to its strength. It has the ability to control an awful lot of pieces in the enterprise, you know, from SharePoint to Exchange to all these other pieces. There's lots and lots of good pieces, lots and lots of pieces that enterprise use every day. I think what Microsoft lacks right now is communications. I think Microsoft needs a communicator for their new CEO. They need to continue the job that Ballmer's already started on breaking down the walls. Just listening to all my friends at Microsoft and how they complain about, that division's doing that. Why can't we do that also? Or, I didn't know that other division was doing that. I think Microsoft needs to start eating its own dog food. I think Microsoft needs to start communicating and sharing technology between divisions. And I think Microsoft needs to bring more of the projects out of Microsoft Research into the mainstream, you know, maybe little bits and pieces. My best example is Microsoft Tag. That was a great technology that was horribly marketed, and maybe it would have done better with better communication.
Curtis, over to you. Same question. The first 100 days of the new CEO, what needs to happen?
I think number one is communicating with people inside the company. I think that the new person at the top of the food chain has to be able to excite the Microsoft employees about what they're doing and convince them that they can be on top again. That's number one. Without that, nothing else is going to happen. Number two is convincing the market, and that means going to the major players, both in the press and in the enterprise space, and convincing them that despite everything that they have heard from a fashion sensitive marketplace, that Microsoft is going to be not only a technology that they can depend on, but a technology that their employees will want to work on. Get those two communication jobs out of the way first, and the rest will follow.
Oliver, as a man who has actually worked for Microsoft, who's been part of the culture, what's your insider look on the exact same question? What would you want to see out of a new CEO?
One, I can't comment too closely due to my agreement, but I will say I disagree with both Curtis and Chiebert. In the first 100 days, if some guy gets up there, especially from the outside, says, I have a clear vision, and tries to communicate that to both the public and the employees, I would hope he gets kicked out. If you can do that before the first 18 months, I think you ought to be kicked out, right? This is such a huge company. And the idea that Microsoft should concentrate on the enterprise, they have. They're winning. And what are you going to do? Throw Xbox out? Stop moving that forward? Stop with the Windows Phone? You can't do that. right? Microsoft is trying to own it end to end. I do believe in that vision. So does Microsoft. So do the people internally. We all dog food our own stuff, whether vendors or internal employees. And most times we like it, right? Right now, there's a lot of question marks with both Office and Windows 8. But under the Windows 7, Windows Server 2008, the Windows Server 2012 section, we all loved it. And by the way, Office, holy mother of God, that is an amazing platform, right? And no enterprise can do without that. And it has zero competition. They are winning. They are dogfooding. And no, they can't toss profitable businesses or profitable directions out of their vision and maintain any kind of leadership going forward.
Oh, I love that. I love that viewpoint. Mary Jo, I want to give you the last word on this. And a slight alteration to the question, and that is, listening to what Oliver has said, what are the sacred cows at Microsoft? For the new CEO coming in, what are the things that he or she really shouldn't touch? Just let it play out, see how they go, and where is there room to innovate?
I never have thought about the sacred cows. I'm always thinking about what they should touch instead of what they shouldn't touch. and one thing I think based on conversations I've had with Microsoft employees and Microsoft customers, one thing I think that the new CEO needs to do is get away from gratuitous secrecy. And I don't mean just put all the business plans out there for all the competitors to see. I don't mean that. But I think Microsoft's gotten in this really weird rut, especially as of late, where they've decided like being secretive, even about things they don't need to be secretive about, is where they should be going. And I think that's really done a lot of harm. I mean, there's people inside the company who just don't even have a clear vision of where products are going that they need to know about. And they need to know about them from an integration standpoint and even from an internal competitive standpoint. And customers especially. I get calls from customers about things like, you know, where's Microsoft going with BizTalk? Are they dropping that product? And, you know, things like BizTalk and System Center and Dynamics CRM, those are things Microsoft doesn't need to be so, so secretive about. Halo, yes. Forefront, no, right? It's like they should be communicating to their enterprise customers more and their internal employees more about things so that they feel like there's a strong, there's a plan, there's a vision. There's not a feeling inside like, okay, now we're in this weird holding pattern because we just reorged and we're going to get the CEO who may or may not know what to do now. They need to give people inside and outside confidence that Microsoft has a plan and they're going to execute on the plan. Whatever the plan is, they just need to feel confident like there is a plan.
Speaking of the plan, let's move on to the next bit of plan that we have. And that is talking about, I think, actually an upbeat story for Microsoft, all about Windows 8.1. Now, only if we had on the show the person who broke the story and could flesh it out. Oh, actually, we do. That's right. Mary Jo Foley, tell me all about 8.1 going RTM.
Okay. So this is a really weird story because Microsoft has not yet publicly announced that Windows 8.1 went RTM. But people I've been talking to late Friday and over the weekend said, yes, there was an internal email that went out to the Windows client division only that confirmed they've gone RTM, that it's done. And I don't know why they're holding off on announcing it. I mean, there was some talk, maybe last Friday wasn't the best day given the Ballmer announcement. But I thought maybe today they would announce it because it would be kind of a nice upbeat story to start the week with, that they had actually finished the next version of Windows and it was going to go to OEMs now and everything was on track. But we haven't heard that still. And it's not because it's not done. I mean, the bits are already out there leaking onto servers out in the wild. It's done for sure. But I think they're trying to figure out how to communicate the message as to when people are going to get these bits. The rumor is nobody is going to get the bits early. So no MSDN, no TechNet, no volume licensees, that everybody's going to have to wait until mid-October when they actually, quote, launch the product. And if that's the case, I think they're going to have to explain this very carefully, why they're doing it this way. People are feeling, if that is the case, you know, is it really not done? Did they RTM a buggy product? Are they going to use the next 2 months to kind of patch it, fix it, update all the apps that ship as part of Windows now? You know, I think they need to be very clear, if it is the case that no one's getting the bits early, why they are not.
Right.
So that may be why there's a little hesitation about announcing this and trying to figure out the correct kind of public way not to put a damper on the fact that the new Windows is done.
Right. Mary Jo, I love the fact that you brought up the fact that this is only going to release to the OEMs, that no one is getting it early. But Chibert, I want you to explain to the folks at home, especially those who maybe don't always play in the enterprise space, what is it about the MSDN people or the TechNet people getting those bits early? Why is that usually important?
Well, MSDN, TechNet, and all those, these are the developers. The MSDN actually stands for Microsoft Developer Network. And when developers get bits early, that means that lag time, the rubber band effect of when are those features going to get integrated into apps. You know, Halo couldn't have gotten out with Kinect support unless the developers had got early. You don't just wave a magic wand and code appears. There's a long development cycle, and if you don't have the hardware or you don't have the bits that you can't test against, that means the end user applications like Halo, like whatevers, if you're not testing it against the actual bits, that means you're not testing and more bugs.
Right.
So I question the wisdom of this, because the developer community needs to be behind Microsoft. We've already seen what happens when the developer community isn't behind a company with Windows Mobile. I love the operating system, but there are no apps for it, or very few apps, or the apps are very late in coming.
Oliver, I want to go over to you, because we've got from Mary Jo's article some of the changes that will be taking place in 8.1. We've got the return of the start button. We've got the ability to boot straight to the desktop. We've got the ability to actually unpin Metro apps. And we have a usable Windows App Store. Together, is that enough to make this a sellable operating system for the enterprise? Enterprise has really shied away from 8. They've wanted 7 or to stay on XP if at all possible. Would this make it an easier sell to say, look, we can make it run a lot like Windows 7. You just have the added stability in the kernel from Windows 8.
No. I mean, put yourself in a CIO's shoes, right? If some guy walks in and says, we'll make it run a lot like Windows 7, well, then why not just stay on Windows 7, right? I think Chibert's right. And I think, I believe Mary Jo said it, I think they got ahead of themselves with 8, right? They were trying to chase the iPad for no apparent reason. And the problem with that is developers did not have time to innovate, right? There's no reason to use 8 yet. There's no reason to have a touch interface on a PC. Why? And they're not using it now. So A, forcing the start menu, yeah, that was not smart. But making it optional, then who the hell's gonna boot into it? I mean, download a Windows 8 a touch app now. What do you get? You get either something mediocre, or it's gonna you press the icon on the 8 side and it drops you right into the Windows 7 screen. And they kind of truncated Windows 7. You're not finding all the features there that you used to find. And that's another mistake. So they need to find a balance, and their developers need to catch up. That partner opportunity needs to catch up. And to Curtis's point, it has to take leaps and bounds. It's got to like have that killer app, right? And they don't have it yet. Even Office is not a killer app on the start menu screen. I guess I can't call it Metro now. I forgot what we were supposed to call it.
Yeah. Curtis, let me go over to you, because you have spoken about this whole idea of leaps and bounds. You have to have that killer app. You have to have the reason why they use the Metro interface. Obviously, we haven't seen it yet. I bring out Metro every once in a while when I want to show off my touchscreen, but most of the time I work from the desktop. Listening to the changes that they're making for 8.1, it really does sound like a backtrack. Or if you want to spin it positively, to say Microsoft listened to its users and have said, look, we hear you. You want this. We're going to give it back to you. But then how do they get back to that point where people start using the touch interface? They start using the Metro interface. Oh, you're muted.
My apologies. I think the way that they get to forcing people to use the Metro interface is helping the growth in tablets. Because let's face it, people reaching up and touching the screen at their desktop is something that we have trained people out of for the past generation of office workers. That's going to be a very tough thing to do. It has to happen on the very mobile platform first. The other thing that they haven't done yet, and this is not so much Microsoft as it is that developer community, we haven't yet seen the application where we go, yes, this is it. Now I understand why this is such a very cool interface. So far, a lot of developers have been porting other applications to Metro. They've been changing from one interface to another, but I have yet to see an interface that truly uses the Metro interface in such a way that we go, yeah, now I know why I've got to go out and buy one of these devices. Or more importantly, this is why I have to convince my company to buy one of these for every employee. Pardon me. Until we get that, we're going to have these things like taking steps backwards, the Windows 7 interface, in order to try to take steps forward in the marketplace.
Right. Mary Jo Foley, I want to give you the last word because you follow Microsoft more closely than any of us. I am looking forward to 8.1. I will install it on my machine. I will install it on all my boxes, my production machines. But I don't see it helping any of the institutes that I've worked with adopt it over 7. What's your take on 8.1?
I don't think we should be looking at the question, will people who are on Windows 7 jump to Windows 8? Because I agree with you guys. I don't see why you would. And I still run Windows 7 on, I have two PCs. I run Windows 7 on both, even though I cover Windows 8. I have a Surface RT as my third device, so I run Windows 8 in that guise there. But right now, there just isn't a reason. I mean, there's no compelling apps that are making me say, I have to do this. There's nothing in the workflow of it either that make me want to do it. I mean, now they're kind of fixing the snap view, so you're going to be able to snap more windows open. But I'm somebody who likes to have windows on windows, and that's kind of what they get away from with the 8. So I don't think we can look at it that way. I think it's more, and I think they're not really looking at it that way either. I think they're saying, okay, when somebody buys a new PC, if they're getting off XP, if they have, you know, requisition at their company to get X number of new PCs or tablets, this is when they're going to get Windows 8.1 or Windows 8 or whatever successor, 8.2 if there is one. I don't think they're thinking people are going to jump from 7 to 8. I don't see them really even acknowledging that themselves. It's more a case of, if you're going to get a tablet, we hope you look at Windows 8 and Windows 8.1. If you're going to get a new PC, we hope you'll look at 8 or 8.1. If you've got a PC running 7 and you're good with it, you're probably not going to go there.
Good. Good words. Mary Jo Foley from All About Microsoft, also the host of Windows Weekly here on the Twit TV network. Thank you very much for joining us. I know you have to go. You do have a busy schedule with everything going on in the Microsoft world. But I want to give you your time to talk to the Twit, right? Tell us what you're doing, what people should be looking at, what people should be looking forward to.
Okay. Yep. So you should be looking in the month of September for some new tablet devices being launched, especially Nokia, it sounds like, is going to have an ARM-based tablet that they may be announcing around September 26 in New York. This could be pretty interesting. It's weird they picked ARM to do a 10.1-inch tablet, supposedly. But yeah, we're going to be watching for that. And then going into October, we're going to be having, hopefully, a whole lot of new hardware that makes Windows 8.1 more interesting. Some 8-inch tablets, some tablets from Microsoft, like the Surface 2 and the Surface 2 Pro, which are their successor tablets to what they have now. So I think it's going to be a very interesting September, October for hardware. And that, you know, in the end, that's what people buy. They buy hardware. They don't go, hey, I want to buy Windows 8.1. So watch for lots of coverage of that in the coming months.
Thanks again for being with us. It's always a pleasure to have you on. Do you want to remind the folks of where they can find you on Windows Weekly?
Sure. So I do a blog called allaboutmicrosoft.com. I'm on Twitter all the time, at Mary Jo Foley. You can always hit me up with questions there. And then we do Windows Weekly. We'll do one this Thursday, in fact. And I'm sure we'll talk more about the reorg and 8.1 and all that good stuff.
We'll have you back as soon as we possibly can, as soon as we can make it work for your schedule. Thanks again for joining us. Now, right after this break, we're going to be talking all about packet capture and analysis. That's right. If you want to know what the NSA is doing with your traffic, how it looks, what it looks like, and what they can determine from what they see, you're going to want to watch. But before then, I want to take time to talk about the second Twit Right sponsor, Lookout. Now, you probably aren't using the same devices that you did 10 years ago, 15 years ago, even 5 years ago. So if that's the case, why are you still using the same security methods from 5, 10, 15 years ago? We need a new way to look at security because PC antivirus solutions aren't the best. And as more and more of our business and personal information moves from the desktop or the laptop into a mobile device, we need a new security paradigm. And that's where Lookout comes into play. Lookout is a mobile security company based out of San Francisco, which is mastering a new approach, securing the next generation of connected devices for 40 million people globally. The Lookout platform is built on the world's largest mobile threat analysis system, and it uses it to protect against malware, spyware, privacy issues, and phishing, among other cybersecurity threats. Lookout for Android, iOS, and Amazon Kindle offers the best protection for your personal device with features like automatic protection from malware, adware, and spyware, a premier Find My Device solution, which includes a really cool feature called Signal Flare. Now, imagine this. If your device is about to run out of battery, you wouldn't be able to track it. But Signal Flare automatically saves your device's last known location when your battery gets low, which significantly improves your chances of finding it even after it runs out of juice. It does automatic data backup and restore and has easy device management from Lookout.com, anywhere, anytime. Lookout worries about security so that you don't have to. They've stopped tens of millions of mobile threats to date, and they have a product for business tools coming soon. Now, here's what we want you to do. We want you to learn more about Lookout for Business or get the free Lookout download for Android, iOS, and Amazon Kindle. So visit lookout.com/enterprise. That's lookout.com/enterprise. And we thank Lookout for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Let's get back to the heart of the matter. We've got a super special guest in studio with us, Mr. Joe Habib from Wild Packets. Joe, thank you very much for being on. You want to tell the Twilight Riot a little bit about who you are and what your company does?
Thanks for having me on. Joe Habib, the Director of Global Services at Wild Packets. And our company has software that intercepts packets that are either going through wired or wireless networks. And it gives us the ability to basically see what's going on, troubleshoot issues, and give a good insight into what the network's really doing.
I like that. A good insight into what the network is really doing. Because when we talk about packet capture, about tapping networks, that's really what we're talking about. We need to know what's running through our networks in order to determine whether or not our resources need to be increased, whether or not we need to allocate more resources for one part of the network or another. But let's specifically talk about one type of tapping, and that is tapping of wireless traffic. Show me how that works. How do I pull packets out of the air, put them into a tool that can analyze them, and actually start looking at the data?
Right. So with the most part, when we're talking about wireless packet capture, we're talking having a device that can go into promiscuous mode. So a radio that can basically listen to everything that is going through the airwave. I've got one with me right here, a little USB dongle. And what this does is we're actually selling this on Amazon.com. If you just do a search on Wild Packets, you'll find this particular one here. And this puts the radio into sniffing mode, which allows it to intercept all of the packets that are on whatever channel it's listening to and then feed that into a protocol analyzer like ours. And once you have that, you can decrypt it if they're using pre-shared keys. And get the full payload. So if you're doing voice over IP over wireless, if you're surfing web pages, anything that you may be doing can easily be broken out and looked at.
I can conceptualize that. I understand what you're talking about when you talk about capturing traffic out of the air. But can you show me what that actually looks like when you run it through a tool?
Absolutely. So what I'm going to do is cut over to my laptop and start a capture. And typically, you'll pick the adapter or the interface. In this case, it will say the Wild Packets API ES, basically meaning that it goes completely into promiscuous mode. From there, we can pick a channel, an individual channel, or we can scan for particular channels. Now, this particular adapter that I have has the ability of doing not only the BG frequency, but also the A frequency, and what you'll notice here with this 40 low is it also can do N. So being able to tune into the correct frequency becomes very critical because if, you know, somebody's broadcasting on a different channel that I'm not listening to, obviously I'm not going to see those packets. So a lot of times just trying to get an idea, let's say from a wireless perspective of what the network's doing, I'll scan channels like what I'm doing right now, and then go ahead and just click OK. And once I do this, I'll start my capture. All the data is coming in basically fed as packets through here. Whoa. But we can see things as far as...
Okay, so describe what the audience is seeing right now. For the audio-only listeners, right now right. He's got a screen with multicolored lines scrolling past furiously.
Right. So I originally started out in a packets view because that's how most people are familiar with protocol analyzers. But the beauty of protocol analyzers, or at least ours, is the ability to break it out and make it simple. So within that packet data... specifically pertaining to wireless, we have the ability to break out. In this case, you'll see the ESS ID, you'll see the access point, and then if there are stations that are associated with it. So the blue here indicates to us that there's an ESS ID. Mm-hmm. This purple color indicates that there's an AP, and then this gold color underneath that AP indicates all the stations. And then we have columns to the right that indicate, for example, is security into effect? Is it a trusted node or not? What type of signal strength you're receiving. And beyond these individual columns, you have other columns that you can enable. And the beauty of this is now you can start to sort by these columns and look for individual things. I can even break it down to say, okay, show me all of the access points in the area. So now you can start to see all of the specific access points that are indicated in purple, what frequencies or what channels they're on, what security, whether they're trusted. And you get a good idea of what's actually taking place within the network. So that's kind of how we start out, just from a high level of a wireless perspective. And then we can also break it down even further by looking at things like protocols. Now, typically within a wireless environment, you're going to have protocols that are control, data, and management traffic. And going into promiscuous mode, you're able to see all of these traffic or all these particular protocols broken out, and what that allows you to do is have a good idea of, number one, is your data encrypted, where we can see here we have a large portion of encrypted data. You'll also get an idea of how much management or control traffic is taking up the airspace. And I think one of the critical things as we're talking about this is understanding that it's open space. And air... nobody really controls it. So, you know, everybody can buy an AP, everybody can put an AP on the same channel, and if that were to happen, then typically wireless performance goes down. So being able to identify, for example, the management traffic on a particular station or how many APs are on a station allow us to tune networks and also ensure the security of those networks as well.
Okay. So what you've done is you've taken a wireless adapter, you've put it into promiscuous mode, so it's not associating with any particular AP. It's just capturing all traffic that's running through the air.
Right.
And you're running it through your tool to give you everything from the SSIDs of APs, the signal strengths, the number of packets that are transferred through them, the protocols of the traffic that's being passed back and forth. Cheever, let me ask you, as someone who's actually gone out and used traffic analysis tools like this, what does this let you do practically? If you're walking through your campus with say, a Wild Packets adapter and their software, how does it help you troubleshoot the network?
Actually, one of the things that I've been doing is, you know, I actually walk around. It helps me go and find out where the access points are and things like that. But the best example is I was actually sitting downtown waiting for my wife to finish work. And just for grins and giggles, I had my Pringles can antenna. I was actually scanning the buildings. I actually found an open AP, and I was looking at the traffic, and I know, and through the traffic, I figured out which bank it was, and also that someone was running unencrypted login. So I was actually seeing logins going by. Good thing is I knew who the IT guys were, and I called them up and said, you guys really want to try and track down this access point because it's spewing unencrypted private stuff. And got a call back in about 10 minutes, and the guy says, look up in the window. And he was holding the access point like a dead rat in the window and saying, I owe you lunch.
God. That's it. I owe you lunch. Joe, let me go back to you.
Yep.
We're talking about wireless traffic capture right now.
Yep.
But I started with wired capture, traffic capture, using Wireshark. Oh, actually, back then, what did we call it before it was
Ethereal.
Wireshark? Ethereal. So tell me, what's the difference between capturing wireless traffic and capturing wired traffic?
So the frame type is going to be a little bit different. So for example, let me just split my screen here, and I can actually show you what it looks like from a protocol perspective. You're going to have 802.11 frame types versus Ethernet 2 type frame types. You're not going to have management control and data as you would in wireless. So there's some framing that is elementary different. The other thing is if I want to capture traffic on a wired side, I'm going to have to hang off of a SPAN port or have a tap in place, whereas on a wireless side, I can just have a dongle or a USB device that goes completely into promiscuous mode, allowing me to see all of the traffic. So, you know, you kind of got to do a bump in the wire if you're going to go wired or, you know, somehow redirect those packets to see it. And the beauty of all of this is everything is completely undetectable because we are completely passive at that point,
right?
Because the packets are just passing through us.
Exactly. Because if it's a wireless AP, those are just signals in the air. So if you're intercepting those signals, nobody else knows. It's just like a television signal. It's RF energy floating through the ether. Whereas if you're trying to take a wired tap, although I prefer that, you actually do have to have some sort of hardware in the network in order to make that work. Now, okay, so we know how we capture traffic, and we've talked extensively about taps. We've actually got a fiber tap on that desk over there. So they know about the technology that allows them to take bits of the traffic. My question to you is, what do we do once we have the traffic? I mean, some of it is self-explanatory. If I have a list of APs and a list of protocols, okay, that helps me do what Chibert was talking about, where you're looking for points of insecurity in your network. But otherwise, when you're receiving gigabytes, terabytes of data off your taps, what do you do with them? I mean, I can't scroll through them line by line.
Right.
What do I need in order to turn that into useful information?
So a big portion of it is understanding visually what are you looking for. Now, in some cases, you may be interested in something as simple as web page reconstruction. Another case may be where you're just looking at response times within flows and conversations. Now, a lot of what you can do within this product is if you have an idea of what you're looking for, you can jump straight to those sections. So, for example, if I take something as simple as a web page request, I can actually show what the contents of those web page that somebody actually went to would be. So if I could cut over to the laptop, I'll show you, here's the basic code of a web page that has been captured. I can display this web page as HTML. You're going to get a warning because just if there was a virus that was in that web page, you would actually, you know, infect your machine as well. But here we can see a web page that has been just reconstructed basically from the packets themselves. So once you have the packets, there's a lot of information that you can tell. So there's an integrated expert within here as well that will show things like retransmissions that are occurring. Or one thing that I will typically do is enable something like worst response time, looking for codes where I have, for example, a 3-minute response time for an HTTP request and breaking it down visually to see where the gaps in the timing are within those packets. So taking some really high-level data from where you have thousands of conversations or many conversations and then sorting on something as simple as response time and then breaking it down even further to, you know, what is the packet timing? I can even come here and see the payload, what individual things were requested from the site.
Wow, so this tool really lets me drill down as deep as I want to get.
Absolutely.
Okay, so what you've been able to do is you've been able to capture a group of packets. You've been able to capture a data stream. Let's say you've got a tap on someone's external. So you're getting every single byte of data that transfers either to or from the internet connection. You can now rebuild anything. You could replay someone whatever they're surfing on their desktop in real time. You can replay VoIP conversations. You can even capture the data from encrypted tunnels. And were you able to break the encryption, you could replay the data going back through those tunnels.
We could decrypt it and show that as well. Yep.
Right. And okay, so when I'm looking at that screen, so the expert mode screen that you just showed me that allows me to drill down, how do I know what's useful? Because I, you know, this is one of the things that I hear from our audience all the time. When they write me, they say, this is a really, really cool tool. I love the fact that you can do this. I'm geeking out over it. But there's just so much data here.
Right.
How do I know what's important to look at?
So one thing you kind of mentioned earlier was clear text traffic, or Brian did a little earlier. And seeing things like POP or SMTP traffic, here's a simple example. I'll double-click on this POP traffic and go look at the payload, and you can see something where there's somebody's password. And it's that simple to where you can go ahead and get that level of information, provided, you know, it's a clear text protocol. And this is where, you know, in certain environments, ensuring that the protocols that are in use are not clear text protocols. And then having the ability to filter and looking at a very high level from a protocol aspect of identifying which of those protocols are encrypted or unencrypted traffic.
Okay. Let me throw back over to my panel. Oliver, I know this is not your bailiwick. You don't normally cover this angle of tech. But seeing how easy it is to capture traffic off of a network, and especially seeing how easy it is to capture traffic off of a wireless network, do you think if more people saw a program like this, saw a video demonstration like this, they'd be more reluctant to transmit clear text data over a wireless network at, say, Starbucks?
Yes, I'm amazed people still do that, period. I mean, I advise anybody who asks me that, no, never, ever do that. So I think a tool like this, A, would let people see the problems with that, and B, would let them fix it.
Yeah. Curtis, what about you? I mean, when we talk about the executive enterprise side, they know about this. I mean, they've been briefed. They've received product briefings. They've gone to the conference, and they've seen the demonstrations. And yet I have found that it's often the execs inside of an enterprise that have the worst problem with security policy, that they know these tools exist, but they just assume that at any given time no one's listening to their data stream. What do you think that's about?
I think that there's a great deal of it that is the result of the sense of privilege, that because they are very important people, that no one would dare listen to their streams. There's another part of it that is familiar to anyone who is the parent of a teenager, the forgetfulness meme. You can tell them again, but when they want to do what they want to do, suddenly amnesia sets in. It can actually be convenient if you're someone who's charged with security, because they'll go off and you get to rap their knuckles for violating things that you've told them about 20 times. Unfortunately, as you say, it is the executives who push the envelopes most consistently. I have yet to meet a security officer who won't tell you that their biggest problems come from the executive suite.
Chibert, I want to throw over to you, because we did have a question in the chat room of is this deep packet inspection? I mean, is this the tool that does deep packet inspection? Explain to them exactly what deep packet inspection means.
Okay, so deep packet inspection has a connotation, and it usually goes with things like UTMs, you know, the new generation of firewalls. So, yes, a protocol analyzer will go and sift through all these things, but there's a certain amount of manual operations involved. The expert mode is great. So when you talk deep packet inspection, it's taking that automation to several layers up. I want to be able to go and say, I want to look for a signature that matches cert advisory number, you know, 6F4C, you know, things like that. So yes, underneath the hood, there's some sort of deep packet inspection. There's some sort of protocol analyzer, but it's many, many layers removed from what Joe's talking about. The wild packets type of protocol analyzer is what you use to go and say, I've got a problem right now. Let's go and see if we can figure this out. You know, things like, why aren't my Wi-Fi clients roaming? Or why is my Wi-Fi-based VoIP tools having so many problems? So that's a tool. Now, you combine that with something like what Wild Packets has. They have a recording device that allows you to record the higher-level information so that you can go back in a historical view and say, okay, Mr. CEO, I've got a I had a problem at 10 p.m. last night when I was calling Japan. With the historical recording, I can go back and try and figure out what's going on. So they are the same thing, but with different abstraction layers.
Joe, I want to throw over to you. We're getting a little bit of a flurry in our chat room right now from people who are freaking out. They're saying, well, how do I defend against this? I mean, I didn't realize my traffic was so easy to tap. So, but we're not, I mean, this is nothing new. This is something that everyone should know about. If you've got anything to do with any kind of technology today, if you're sending data over the internet, you should know that these tools exist. And that means you should play with them. You should load something like this on your laptop, on your desktop, and actually see what transfers through your network and what you can see, how easy it is to analyze that traffic. Let me ask you, what are the things that you want to look for in your traffic capture program?
Right. So I think one of the critical things that you're going to be looking for is ease of use. So how easy can I display the data, visualize what I'm looking at? Because, you know, as we mentioned, when people were originally looking at this, they were looking at a packet level view where it was, you know, streams of decodes and everything. A lot of being able to visualize what you're looking at becomes very important, especially for people who this is very new to. So understanding, for example, in, you know, a single click showing the protocols and seeing something as clear text as HTTP, breaking down the nodes as to what stations are connecting to what, become very critical, because what that allows you to do is really understand what your machine is doing. So one thing, you know, just using myself as an example, I'll run this on my home network, you know, set up a span port or make a homemade little tap and inject it in the wire and watch to see what my home machines are doing. Are they making connections? Or I think the most interesting part is just leave your machine idle and watch how much chatter out to the internet or other things your box is doing and validating what type of programs you have and what they're connecting to. And I think in the mobile device community, especially with all the apps and all of the sign-ons that people are doing or accepting these agreements that personal information is being sent back and forth, this actually gives you an idea or a way to see what is that happening over that communication, what's being sent, what type of information is being sent as well.
Well, I want to keep talking, but unfortunately, we've gone way past our hour. That's right. You've used up another hour listening to the best dang enterprise tech show in the universe. I took a poll on Straw Poll. You can find that. Yes, it's true. But before we go, I did want to thank our panelists for making this possible. It's been an absolutely packed show with Mary Jo Foley. Thank you very much for joining us. But over to you, Brian. I love having you on. I couldn't do Twite without you. And so what's going on in your world? What do you need people to know about?
Actually, I think since we're talking about packet sniffers and protocol analyzers and so forth, my suggestion to the Twight Riot is consider setting up a VPN account for yourself. Set it up as a tunnel all configuration so that 100% of your traffic goes down the VPN pipe, not just the stuff heading to your enterprise. That way, when you're at a public hotspot, no one can see it if they haven't broken your key. So tunnel all, VPN, check with your IT group. They're not hard to build. They do have overhead, but they are a wonderful thing to help protect you when you're at a public hotspot.
Absolutely. Oliver, thank you for coming back. We're going to have you on more often because the show is just a lot more fun when you're here. I know you're moving back to the East Coast, but is there anything people should watch for if they want to find out what you're doing in the world?
Now, in the near future, I am slowly working on a private cloud bake-off, which I probably mentioned last time with Brian, actually. I'm trying to scam a free trip to Hawaii out of it. Because of the move, yes, it's going very, very slowly, so I don't expect to see it till later in the year or even later. But that will be the extent of my technical projects at the moment.
Speaking of technical projects, we've got Curtis Franklin. Curtis, what's going on at Enterprise Efficiency?
Well, we have our entire fall lineup getting underway. We're going to be doing a lot of E2 radio for September, October, November. We're also beginning the travel schedule in October. I'll be heading off to Gartner, as well as spending time up in Redmond, Washington, and then out in Las Vegas for SAP's Tech Ed. Hope we'll be able to see a lot of the Twiat Riot while I'm on the road.
Absolutely. And Joe Habib, thank you for coming in. We actually want to have you on more often because this was just a 10,000-foot cursory view. We want to get deep into what it looks like when you're actually analyzing traffic network flows. And I do have to say that looking at the chat room and seeing how much you freaked some of them out, your kung fu is strong. So tell us, what's going on at Wild Packets? Where can they find out about you? Where can they find out about your software?
So going simply to wildpackets.com, you'll can actually request an evaluation so you can download the software, play with it. It is a Windows-based platform software, but you can run in Parallels if you're on a Mac. We also have a bunch of what we call our workshops taking place geographically, domestically across the U.S. So look for those as far as our, on our events page, and that'll actually get you into a session with one of our engineers, and they'll actually install the software with you and go through some trace files and some examples as well.
Thank you. We'll definitely have to have you back when we've got more time. Now, I also want to thank everyone here who has made this possible, to Karsten, my super producer, and to, Jason Howell, who I hear also has his own show. Jason, you're a host on the Twit TV network, are you not?
Yeah, I do that from time to time, you know, in my off time when I'm... I don't even know what I'm saying anymore. But I do want to say that I'm really going to miss Steve Ballmer chasing cake. I really hope that the next CEO will give us as many awesome animated GIFs as Steve has done. But yes, you can find me at twit.tv/AAA. All About Android. It's my show.
Thank you.
There you go.
And you know who else I want to thank? I want to thank you. That's right, our loyal audience for coming back, for downloading, for watching us live. So I want to do something for you. I want to give you a way to get every episode of Twit automatically delivered into your device of choice. The way that you do that is by going to our show page at twit.tv/Twit. There you'll be able to find a menu that gives you all the different ways you can get every episode of Enterprise Goodness delivered into your iPad, your iPhone, your Android tablet, your Android phone, your Windows mobile phone, your Zune, whatever it might be. We're going to find the format that fits you best. Also, you can find us at our Twit YouTube page at youtube.com/Twit. There you'll be able to find not just all of our episodes, but all of our individual segments. If you want to learn about stuff my IT guy says or the data center, that's the place to do it. Also, did you know that we do this show live? That's right. Every Monday, noon Pacific, we are here in the Twit TV studio. And if you watch live, you get to see how the sausage is made. The things that don't go into the final download, trust me, it's worth it. And as long as you're there, why not log into our live chat room at irc.twit.tv? There you'll be able to meet some brilliant engineers, some really funny trolls, and yes, experience the temporary community that is Twit. Finally, I want to thank CyberDog in the chat room and everyone else here at Twit TV who made this possible. I'm Father Robert Ballinser, reminding you that if you want to know what's going on in the enterprise, just keep quiet.